Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are rewinding back to December the 16th, 2011. This was originally episode 805. Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms. This is a great interview. We talked about how homesteaders can adapt to some of Joel's techniques, like raising small livestock and poultry, rabbits, and the importance of ethical slaughter. We moved on to leader-follower grazing systems. We talked about helping local producers by being their customers. We talked about some of the biggest challenges to small farmers and homesteaders that there are today. Of course, this was more than 10 years ago, and the same problems still exist. We also talked about how farmers could transition from what we would call traditional agriculture, which I think is more accurately chemical agriculture, to more natural production and increase profits at the same time. That's about all I need to say for this intro, except I want to say something else. When I did this episode, I had been podcasting for, 3 years, roughly. I was just really coming into my own, into the permaculture, regenerative agriculture type space. And I met Joel at Liberty Forum, and I struck up a conversation with him there and was really excited that I was able to get him on the show from doing that. And this was a big deal for me, to have Joel Salatin on the Survival Podcast when it wasn't even quite 3 years old yet. That was a big freaking deal. And I want to send this out to everybody out there that wants to build something of their own about what's possible if you commit and make an effort. I've now been to at least a dozen events that Joel Salatin was at as a speaker, and I was also speaking at these same events. And in just about every one of those events, he was kind enough to mention me while he was doing his talk, point to me in the audience. He even one time sort of infamously said that, gee, I thought Jack Spirko was going to shoot me. I'm not going to tell you the whole story if you don't know it. It did really happen. He was never going to get shot. I was reading a Star Trek novel. He got in really late, and we were sharing an Airbnb. That's as far as I'll go with it. But I think he meant it as a joke, but just a little bit like, hey, I walked in on Jack's room by accident. To build something to a level where you have someone like Joel treating you as a contemporary and all the other great people that do that. Now, many of whom I looked up to as heroes when I was starting out. You know, I had a lot of success in business, but not in this space. To me, this is like one of the better achievements that we've been able to make as a community together at TSPC is to have people like this. You know, it'll take a phone call from you. It'll come on the show. I just had Joel on not that long ago again. I just had Tom Woods reach out to me today. I'm recording this the day before it's released as a flashback, so this is Thursday, asking if I would come on his show and talk about my new book. I was just getting ready to start to put together a one-pager and all to get on people's podcasts to talk about the new book. So that's a different world. That's, of course, Laws of Life. All I'm saying is all of this came from one day I got in my car and started a podcast with a $35 recorder and a $20 headset. And in the beginning, I didn't even have the headset. That's how bad the audio was. Whatever you want to achieve is doable. But here's the kicker. back before I started the show, but I was in that space where, like, I don't want to be in this corporate world anymore. I don't want employees anymore. I don't want any of the trouble. I want something completely solopreneur. If you would have asked me to kind of outline what success would look like, it wouldn't have been this. It was the journey that became the discovery that led to this. And that all comes from just, there has to be something inside of you. Something with a hunger. And then you channel that hunger. So I'll use that as a little bit of a pimpin' to sell my book that's coming out on Monday, Laws of Life. That's what that book is. That book is the framework that got me where I am. And I invite you to take it, make it your framework, and discover what you can discover about what your life's purpose and mission really is. For me, it turned out it was building Survival Podcasts, the community, and bringing people like this together. You know, when you talk about Joel Salat and Tom Woods, you know, and some of the other people that we have on and we brought in, all different worlds, but all a common mindset: liberty, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and independence. With that, let's go ahead and flash on back to 12/16/11, originally episode 805, Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms. With that, I've got the housekeeping wrapped up, and like I said, now I get to introduce, you know, one of my true heroes in business and in agriculture, Joel Salatin. Joel is an awesome guy. I have to say, this is a guy that's beyond organic in so many ways, even though he uses the term organic often. He has demonstrated that a lot of the things that people talk about in theory can be done in practice. He does things in an incredibly ethical way. He does things in an incredibly natural way, and he's an activist trying to teach other people how to do it rather than, let's say, keep the secret sauce to himself. And I'm like totally stoked to be able to say this. Hey, Joel, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on today. I think most of my listeners probably know quite a bit about you, but if you could maybe give just a brief introduction to yourself about, you know, kind of what your philosophy is and what you've been doing lately, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, I'm a farmer in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. We farm pastured livestock, so we have beef, pork, chicken, both eggs and meat, and turkeys and rabbits. We also have forestry products. And the main thing that's different is that we run these on pasture rather than in confinement houses. We have portable infrastructure. We do large-scale composting. We don't buy, you know, chemical fertilizers. And we direct market everything to about 5,000 families and 50 restaurants and about 10 retail facades.
Yeah, and you've also been quite prolific as an author. You've got a ton of books I want to chat about a little bit, but in a lot of your work as far as speaking, just what you're doing as far as how, proving it can be done, and your writing, you've really been a big voice for other small farmers, other small producers, in things that are challenging, let's say, in today's environment. Both politically and just guess on the ground as a farmer as a whole. Can you talk about maybe some of the biggest challenges there are right now to folks that are trying to do things kind of in an all-natural / organic / just better for the environment way?
Yeah, well, probably the single biggest challenge right now is simply government regulation and intervention. You know, this whole paradigm of local, you know, local food and viewing animals and plants as fundamentally biological rather than mechanical. These are huge departures from what has become, what has become normal for the last, 4 or 5 decades. And, the fact is that this is extreme abnormality of thought when we look at human civilization at history, but human civilization has always had embedded food systems, you know, food grown close to home, carbon cycling, nature works on carbon cycling on site rather than carbon being transferred, you know, from one place to another. And so one of the biggest issues right now is simply the ability to restart what has been historically normal in a time when the average person, from your neighbor to government agents, don't have a clue what normal is.
Makes me think of your book, Folks, This Ain't Normal.
That's right.
Yeah, here's my really, I guess my point of confusion. I know that usually when something comes from a government, not to be excited about it as it is, but when I do look at the marketplace that I see more and more people asking for this. And generally speaking, that then like business tends to get on board with that and get out of the way because they want to serve the market. So there's this huge growing market for people saying, I want to eat locally, I want to eat healthy, I want to know who produced my food, and yet we still have all these huge roadblocks just being plugged into it. Do you see kind of, is it just the conflict of big ag versus small ag, or is it well-meaning idiots in the government, or is there something more malicious at stake? I mean, what is causing, you know, raids on, raw milk producers and things like that? People that are selling direct to the public, having people come down on new legislation getting in the way. What's the big driver in that?
Yeah, well, it's the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I mean, that's the driver of it. We live in a culture where, where the idea of self-reliance and self-determinism is criminalized or demonized. And we live in a culture now where the government says, they own the individual. I mean, the Food and Drug Administration has now gone on record in writing saying that a citizen does not have a fundamental right to choose the food that they want to eat. That's a fundamental departure from Washingtonian and Jeffersonian constitutional thought, where we had the freedom for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or pursuit of property, in a culture where we have the right to pursue that for myself. I'm astounded that we would so quickly say that I don't own myself, and I don't even own the 3 trillion member community of bacteria that's in my inside, that I don't have the right to choose what should or should not fuel them. And so what we have now is an entire, a food police network in this country, built up, from sincere-minded thinking. I mean, I don't use the word conspiracy. Then you're a nut if you use it. So I use the word fraternity of ideas,
mm-hmm.
and what we have is this huge food police infrastructure that now says it's perfectly fine and safe and legal to feed your kids Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew, but raw milk, Aunt Matilda's homegrown pickles,
yeah,
and compost-grown tomatoes. Now those are hazardous substances.
And it's crazy, and I don't know if you heard about this. You probably did. You're probably more plugged into this than I am. But the judge that handed down that ruling about not having the right to choose your own food, I think it was in Wisconsin or whatever, he's now working for a lobbying firm that's hired by Monsanto. He basically quit his job like a couple months after that, and now he works for a legal firm that does lobbying work for Monsanto.
Wow. Now, I didn't realize that he quit his judgeship. I knew about the ruling. And I'm not surprised. I expect Monsanto, when they found a guy that was that far askew in their corner, they probably offered him way more than he was making as a judge to come and work for them.
When I saw that, the only thing that I had disbelief about, I'm like, well, you would think they would at least wait like 6 months or something just to, you know what I mean, just for appearances or something like that. But it was relatively quick. My wife does a lot of research for me, and she had sent me the email. Like right after I just got done ranting about it, all of a sudden he's going to work for this. And it's not directly for Monsanto as the report came out, but it's a legal firm, so it's kind of they did a one-off thing, So Monsanto employs this firm, and I guess you see a lot of stuff like that out there.
Well, no, we do. That's what I call the fraternity of ideas. I mean, people have to understand that when they say, I want the government to protect me, or I want the government to give me a safety net, really, you can't inject the government into our lives more without giving up freedoms. And this whole balance between risk and freedom. You can't offer freedom without also allowing people the risk of making stupid choices, stupid decisions. I mean, you know, I think people make stupid choices all the time. I mean, people smoke, people overdrink, people drive drunk, people eat Twinkies and Cocoa Puffs and four sodas a day and go eat, you know, DiGiorno's frozen pizza. And I think people make all sorts of very, very risky decisions. And so, you know, it should give us pause when we realize the extent to which the government has penetrated into the marketplace to determine what you and I have the choice to do, and especially when it comes to food, you know, to eat. And so what we have now, for example, is, you know, farmers like me that have chickens out on pasture, you know, we're now labeled bioterrorists because our chickens commiserate with red-winged blackbirds and indigo buntings and transfer our alleged diseases to the science-based, environmentally controlled Tyson chicken houses and threaten the planet's food supply.
Huh.
So, you know, it's that kind of thinking that is coming in, again, I think totally, in most cases, sincerely, but sincerely wrong.
Yeah, I would agree it's sincerely wrong. I've been recently talking a lot about genetically modified foods and the threat they pose. And I get a lot of this stuff that's kind of like pushback on it, you know, where you're just holding back progress. And my thoughts have always been, oh, hold on a second. Let's just say the GMO part itself. Let's just say we'll shelve that and we'll argue about whether it's okay to modify the thing in a second. Let's shelve the patenting of a life form for a second. Let's even shelve the fact that they're modifying a soybean, spraying it with Roundup, and then you're eating it, and we'll shelve that. What about this? And this is what I don't hear people talk about. A farmer gets sold on applying an herbicide-ready product to his field, and for 10 years they grow that, and they saturate that field with Roundup or atrazine or any of the other herbicides they modify this stuff to do. What happens when that farmer then says, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore, and tries to go a more natural route and plant a different crop there, and it's not been genetically modified to deal with that substance that's now left in his field, that they say, don't worry, it's biodegradable. To me, it's not biodegradable, and it almost locks the land up into this model.
Yeah, well, I would even go one step further. I find it unconscionable that so many conservatives defend GMOs on exactly like you said, on the basis of progress and scientific scientific development, blah blah blah. But the problem with, to me, one of the most fundamental problems with GMOs is that they are ubiquitous. They you can't keep them at home. And if there's one thing that the property rights defenders need to be defending, it is the right of me to, to decide what happens on my property. And the fact that our courts have now ruled that if Monsanto makes some strange life form that that comes across my boundaries and impregnates my crop with brand new life forms that I don't want, not only can I not sue Monsanto for property right infringement, I have to pay Monsanto for a royalty for the privilege of them impregnating my plants with a life form that I don't want. I mean, think about it. If a neighbor had a dog get loose and bred all the neighbor's female dogs and with some form of, you know, two-headed Franken-dog thing, the neighbors would be up in arms and lynch that guy for letting his dog get loose and run rampant in the neighborhood, impregnating everybody's dogs. But here we have a situation where Monsanto is doing exactly this, and the courts are holding the people with the new Franken-dogs as patent infringements on the life form that Monsanto owns.
They have to pay a stud fee to the neighbor who let the Franken-dog go.
Yeah, pay a stud fee to the guy that let his dog get loose, run rampant in the neighborhood. I mean, it's beyond speakable. And yet we have many in the conservative movement who are the biggest, even the libertarian movement, who are the largest defenders of this technology.
I think a lot of them, Joe, I think a lot of them don't know. I don't think they get it. They just think it's a bunch of hippies saying, hey, look, this is dangerous. And they don't actually understand the damage that's being done, because I don't see how, especially a libertarian, could defend the stance that if your ox scores my cattle, it's my responsibility. It goes that far back that it's my responsibility to fence my dangerous animals in, not your responsibility to fence them out. That's as old as written language goes.
Well, sure. That goes clear back to biblical Levitical law. You know, if I have an ox that gets out and hurts you, that ox is an extension of my persona. And in fact, if that ox was known to have been, I don't know what Leviticus calls it, but
dangerous, let's just say,
to have been a problem, and it hurt and it goes over and kills you, then I am put to death for the action of my ox. Now, if it's a first time offender, then I don't get the death penalty. But that's how important this extension of property rights is. And which brings me to the thought, a lot of people think, people like me that are fairly libertarian minded think that, boy, aren't we glad that we have all these environmental laws and regulations. Well, in my view, we shouldn't have had an EPA to tell us that it's wrong for DuPont to dump mercury in the river and that goes downstream and pollutes everybody's water. We shouldn't have had an EPA for that. The executives, the corporate presidents or whatever, stockholders of DuPont should have been brought to court simply on trespass infringement and made to clean it up. We didn't need an EPA for all that.
You bring a good point up there. It's not their place to pollute. It's one thing if you pollute your place, but when you let your pollution spill outside of your boundaries, it's damage to it. One law takes care of everything in kind of a way. I don't want to go totally activist with this interview, though, because people that listen to this show really listen to find out what they can do. And we can talk about some of the stuff people can do as an activist, but what I mean is people that listen to this show are very big into self-reliance and self-sufficiency. And a lot of them are small farmers, small producers. Some of them are just homesteaders. And a lot of them, up until now or up until recently, have been doing things in a, let's call it a conventional, which we both know is an insane way. But they're saying, now how do I transition? So, I mean, as a farmer, and I would almost say you're like a farmer and a rancher, because you've got animals in there, and I guess it's all farming, but you've integrated those two components together. Are there certain things that you've learned that even, let's say, just the homesteader can use as they make that transition, or the small farmer that says, I'm afraid I'm going to go broke if I do this, and I think they can actually be a lot more profitable, but that first toe in the water is a little scary, I guess.
Well, sure it is. There are basic things. First of all, if you're, let's say you have a backyard, you have a small farm, you're whatever. The first thing is that you want to grow food for yourself, and growing food for yourself means that you have to have fertility of some sort. Fertility is always driven by carbon, and so what you want to do is recycle your carbon on site. So one of the best things that anybody can do, for example, is at least have enough chickens to take care of your own kitchen scraps. They give you your eggs. Now you don't have to buy eggs anymore. And they recycle your kitchen scraps so you don't have to compost them. And you have manure instead. That's one of the easiest things. And a couple of chickens, don't take any more room than a couple of parakeets or a fish aquarium. And up to 11 chickens don't eat any more feed than an average American pet dog. So, when we look at actual food costs and what we get out of it, wouldn't you much rather have half a dozen eggs a day than feed a pet dog and have to clean out his manure all the time?
And brush him and everything and take him to the vet and all that. Not that we want to get rid of our dog, but it's a comparison, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's what we really what we really want to do. And so if you really want to be self-reliant, you appreciate the true costs of some of these more esoteric ancillary things, and you say, well, we're going to focus on self-reliance first. So, I'm a big fan of what I call kitchen chickens. because it solves so many problems. It solves your kitchen scraps. It solves eggs, and it solves a fertility issue. So you kill a lot of birds with one stone there. And then, of course, vegetable production or produce production, then you want to go to producing as much of your produce as you can, including season extension. And so now we're talking about hoop houses, greenhouses. I was just up in Fargo, North Dakota 2 weeks ago, met a couple that have put together a passive solar greenhouse from Minneapolis. They're raising green spinach, bok choy, mesclun mix in a passive solar greenhouse in Minneapolis. They have a 12-person CSA, community supported agriculture, 12 boxes a week portion out of this little 30 by 20 facility. And this is from October 1 to April 1 in Minneapolis. I have seen the most amazing things that people are doing with heat sink technology. These folks dug a pit, for example. They took the footprint of their greenhouse, dug a pit, filled it with rock, put leaky pipe in it, 4-inch leaky pipe, and they pumped the heat from the greenhouse into the stone pit during the daytime and then release it out at night. And this creates a heat sink so they can grow all this stuff in the winter without supplemental heat. These are simple things that we know. So, from a self-reliant standpoint, you want to produce your own food, and then you want to extend your season for as long as possible using these cool cloches and technologies like Elliot Coleman documents in his Four Season Harvest book. And then beyond that, if you want to move into things like, beehives to get your own sweetener, beehives can be put on an upstairs patio or a shelf that you hang off the edge of the house.
I've seen them done on roofs too, because it gets them up out of that, up out of the flight path of flying through people,
Absolutely, yeah, especially for children and things like that. And then, if you have, you're going to live in a house, every house should have a southern solarium on it. That solarium can be as simple as just taking a couple of cattle panels and bending it in an arc, putting it plastic over it, putting some 55-gallon drums painted black with water in there as a trombe wall, as a heat sink, and boom, now you're not only heating your house with solar, but you're also growing your seasonal extension greens through the wintertime. And so these are all things that can be done on a domestic scale that are very simple, they're very low cost, and one action has a lot of effects from it, which is one of the reasons, one of the things we want to do is always have multiple benefits from a single action.
Very permaculture-esque principle there. Each item has functions and interactions, inputs, and requirements, and those all should be thought of when you put things together so you can figure out where to place them in a design so they interact with each other.
Exactly. And one of the beauties of portable infrastructure for animals, whether it's, whether it's rabbits or chickens or sheep or whatever, pigs, one of the beauties of portable infrastructure is that it is dynamic, and you're not locking yourself in that this is the way I'm going to pour this concrete pad, and this is where this place is going to be, now for the foreseeable future. Instead, with portable shelters, you can move these things around, change the placement as you live and learn, how to do things better and more efficiently.
Yeah, I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about what I think it's your son is actually really kind of heading this thing up with the rabbits and doing that almost like you guys do, like hog tractoring and chicken tractoring. Well, is he basically doing, because I didn't get to look at it really deeply yet, like it almost looks like rabbit tractoring.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. We call them hairpins. You get to the field, into the field, you make a hairpin turn.
Okay.
Hairpin. what this is, of course, the difference between rabbits and chickens is, there are two primary differences. One is rabbits will eat up to 75% of their diet off of your lawn. So now you're suddenly, you shut the lawnmower off, And you don't have to, you don't have to keep that running, and you can mow your lawn with the rabbits and the chickens. And so you take what would normally be a liability, you know, your lawn that has to be mowed and taken care of, and you turn it into a profit enterprise. So rabbits are much more herbivorous than chickens. The second big difference, though, which is negative, is that if the rabbits get out, they're very hard to catch. You know, chicken, you can kind of, you know, run down corner. They're not the brightest.
You can shake a can of feed, and they come to you.
Well, so the rabbits, the way we house those outside in these hairpins is a slatted floor. We just take little laths, half an inch by 1 inch, and tack it to the bottom of a set of ribs. And the pen is maybe 3 feet wide and 6 feet long. It's not very big, but it's plenty big enough for, you know, for a dozen bunnies in there. And the slats, these half inch by 1 inch thick laths, they are put on 3 inch centers, so that 70% of the bottom of the pen is open to the ground. So that, you know, it's like two inches by 12 inches is the, you know, is each square, and the rabbits can eat the grass through those squares. And yet they can't dig out. You know, these are very light. They only weigh about 20 pounds. You know, a 5-year-old child could move them. Extremely light. And suddenly you take your lawn and, you know, 1 acre of grass put through rabbits is worth $45,000.
Wow.
you know, suddenly you have a full-time income from 1 acre of grass.
No, that's primarily for your bunnies you're raising out for meat. So like your breeders, because you have issues with does castrating bucks if they're not kept separated or one's brought to the other the wrong way. So what are you doing with your breeder rabbits? Are they just kind of in smaller versions or what?
The breeder rabbits are in hanging cages, more similar to a regular house. Yeah, one of the problems with having the breeding stock outside is that that does, the female rabbits, when they get stressed, they'll often eat their bunnies. It's a kind of defensive mechanism inherent in them. And what happens is when you have them out in these pens at night, these does with a little set of bunnies, you know, there's foxes, there's dogs, there's possums, all sorts of disturbance, I mean, kids, whatever, comes along. And so it's important for them to kind of be quiet. So we actually hang them in a separate shed structure with chickens underneath with deep bedding. And deep bedding being, you know, chips, sawdust, wood chips, any kind of carbonaceous material. And the chickens then scratch through what the rabbits drop and the urine that the rabbits put down. And the chickens stirring what I call a carbonaceous diaper there. The chicken stirring it keeps it composting and aerating, so it grows little worms and roly-polies, and actually adds protein for the chickens, and it eliminates the ammonia vaporization that would go up and affect the rabbits. So again, you're taking a structure and you're using the vertical space, which is another permaculture concept, using vertical space instead of just linear space. So you're using the cubic footage of the interior space rather than just linear floor space. Suddenly, you take this footprint of a structure, whether it's 10 by 12 or 12 by 12 or 20 by 12 or 100 by 20 or whatever it is, you take this square footage and you greatly increase its productive capacity by tiering these complementary species in the same space.
Yeah, you're stacking in space there. You're also stacking in time because you're getting a time function out of the breakdown of the organic matter, and you're also using time to gain an additional yield of protein.
Exactly. And the beauty of this, too, is that when you're stacking like this, you don't have to justify the cost of the building with just one enterprise. Now you're running several enterprises through there, from, you know, compost generation to poultry, to the rabbits. You're running multiple enterprises through there, and then you can use the walls of the structure, you know, to grow cucumber vines on, you know, as lattice.
Sure.
And a solarium on the south side. You know, so suddenly you start hanging these things around a structure, and suddenly that structure becomes extremely far more valuable than it would if you were just running one enterprise through. And that means that you can reduce the density of each enterprise down to a density that is not as attractive to pathogenicity. And that's where you have a huge, a huge positive, because you're able to keep the numbers down in a more normal amount.
Yeah, and it's funny, because as soon as you start to do that, like, other opportunities just kind of present themselves. When you were talking about planting cucumbers or beans growing up the structure, I'm thinking, and then that's going to provide shade for the rabbits in the hottest part of the year, and help with thermal regulation. And it just all starts to cascade on itself. But, you know, we're talking about animals here, right? So, like, a lot of people have problems with, like, the fact that if you're going to raise these animals, at least some of them you're raising for eventual slaughter. And I think that the way you do things and the way you're teaching people to do things leads to a lot more ethical treatment and ethical slaughter. I read an article, I don't remember what magazine it was, but it was about you, and it was a quote from you, and I'll never get it exactly right, but it really, like, it was the thing that really tied me into you for good. And it was, you were talking about on days when it's days to slaughter, and you basically said, don't do it every day, because if you do, you'll lose sensitivity from it. You'll have zero regret when you do it, and there should be some feeling whenever you take an animal's life. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because that nailed me.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Look, we got to establish that everything is eating and being eaten. And so there's certainly nothing anti-ecological or spiritual or whatever about eating animals, because the fact is everything's eating and being eaten. And if you don't believe it, you know, go lie naked in your flower bed for 3 days and see what gets eaten. So we got to get over this thing. The predator-prey relationship is just fundamental to ecology. The fact that something has to die in order to decompose and give life to something else that regenerates is a cornerstone of ecology. And yet, as humans, we need to continue to be aware of the sacrifice. We need to be aware of just the reality of sacrifice, and it is a big thing. And so I think that it's not healthy for a person to just kill animals every single day. It's just not emotionally healthy. Even, you know, and I go back to precedent, and again, we go back to Leviticus. You know, the priests actually drew straws to do 1 month sacrificial duties in the temple, and wrote, you know, so they rotated out, you know, I'll wash the knives this month, you do the sacrifices this month, and then they drew straws, you know, and they rotated around, because it simply is not a healthy thing to be, killing animals all the time. And that's one of my problems with, you know, big slaughterhouses and big industrial slaughter plants, is that, there isn't a rotation through. We own a small federal inspected slaughterhouse up in Harrisonburg, and we only kill, I think, 3 days a week. And so the guys who work the kill floors 3 days a week are actually doing other things the other couple of days a week. And I think that is a much more healthy way to approach it.
Yeah, it speaks to me. I grew up, we gardened. We were kind of like homesteaders before anybody called it that, or we were preppers before anybody called it that. And, you know, we had our about our acre and a half little homestead with our garden. It was probably made up of half of an acre. And I was a big hunter as well. That was a big part of how protein came into the household. I'm from Pennsylvania. You're from Virginia, so you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
Yep. You know, I mean, where I'm from, they still close school on the first day of deer season. And when I started archery hunting as a teenager, and I've got my first just beautiful deer, and I had some regret with it. And what my uncle told me is, you've earned it. And what he meant was, because you have the regret, you've earned the right to take the animal.
Yeah. And I would say that the sacredness of sacrifice is elevated by honoring and respecting the animal in life. And so, you know, some of the Native American traditions have this, you know, where you honor the animal in death, you know, thank you for giving your life for me. They have these, you know, little prayers and chants and things. And I think that's a very healthy thing to appreciate, that without death, there could be no life, and to have life requires death. That creates a sacredness and a preciousness to life that doesn't exist when you just view animals as inanimate piles of protoplasmic structure to be manipulated, however cleverly Hubris can imagine to manipulate them. And that doesn't give anybody the right to take the life of anything when you have disrespected it through life. That simply desecrates what should be a very sacred thing.
Yeah, the real circle of life versus the Disney version where warthogs and lions hang out together.
Yeah, either extreme, you hit the nail on the head. Either extreme, whether, you know, the extreme of Bambiitism or the extreme of, you know, Tysonism, either extreme is a problem.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to tell you this because I thought you'd kind of like to hear this, honestly. There's a local farmer's market here that my wife and I go to, and we've tried to talk to everybody down there, get to know our local producers, and we found one farm that we buy quite a bit from. We buy pastured poultry from. We're going to be reserving a hog with them. And when I was talking to them, the farm's called JB Farms, and apparently they're, like, probably without you knowing it, huge students of yours. And they're primary meat production. They do some rabbits, too, but they're doing hogs and chickens, like, one behind the other. And
right.
He's like, he was talking about how much feed they give them because they can get X percentage off the land. And I was just wondering, you know, with that, could you kind of give it, kind of explain that system, how you do that? Because I think it's pretty fascinating.
Well, sure. Well, the fact is that every animal it will eat a certain amount of pasture and is a certain amount of has enough have some scavenging. Every animal has some scavenging potential, and so. So poultry, birds will eat up to like 15 to 20% of their diet off the land, and in fact, if you don't crowd them, you know, for example, laying hens, if you don't crowd them at all, if you just have a couple in a very non-dense situation, they can almost live off the land in the summertime with grasshoppers and crickets and worms and grubs and you know, little seeds and things that they find. So, you know, the omnivores, the poultry and the hogs, are extremely resourceful that way. The pigs, we actually run the pigs in sections of forest under oak trees, and they pick up a tremendous amount of acorns. One acre of oak forest put through pigs will save at minimum $300 and at maximum $600 worth of feed cost. That's a huge amount of feed cost from just an acre of woods. And so this brings up the potential for your homesteader that you mentioned, your self-reliant homesteader, of what we call farming the edges. You know, you don't have to have all big fields and pristine areas. There are so many little corners and edges that we can tuck a few animals in with portable electric fencing and portable sheltering systems in order to scavenge out of some of these unproductive or heretofore unused areas.
Yeah, you've got. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, so there is a definite, you know, leader follower potential here, and whether it's, you know, pigs going through scavenging, you know, chickens harvesting grass, chickens we follow cows with the chickens. The chickens scratch through the cow patties and eat out the fly larvae. And sanitize the paddock before the cows come in. We use hogs to turn our compost. We call them piggerators. Put some corn in, and the pigs then seek the corn. The pigs then fluff up and aerate the compost, and that it keeps us from having to do it, you know, by hand, which cuts down labor costs, cuts down machinery costs, petroleum costs. You know, these are basic principles that I've described, of course, in all my books. But they're fundamental to making an extremely efficient, you know, agrarian model.
Yeah, I'm just thinking feeding hogs acorns is well regarded in Spain, and people pay like $75 a pound for certain ham that's made off of acorn finished certain hogs over there. And I've got this
black-footed hogs in the Iberian Peninsula. You know, they'll charge. I've seen it at $1,000 a ham for those, you know, 5-year cured hams. And so yes, omnivores like that, especially hogs, running in woods has been, you know, a historically normal model for way, way longer than Smithfield has tried to confine them on slatted floors over lagoons and houses.
Well, absolutely, and this is where they're from. I mean, that's where a wild hog lives, and anybody that's hunted them in anything from, like, let's say Arkansas East knows that if you find thickets of acorns in the fall and there are hogs in the area, that is prime hunting territory.
You better believe it.
So that's what they like. That's where they live. And then we try to feed them corn in a cage and wonder why we have diseases and problems and unhappy hogs.
Right. Actually, hogs that are fattened on acorns, their oil, when you cook them, the oil that comes out of the fat is actually known kind of as olive oil. It's a very, very similar consistency to olive oil because of the different kinds of fats that are in the acorns as opposed to corn.
I've got a little debate with some folks out there, and I wonder if you could solve real quick for me. I've had people say you got to keep your chickens away from acorns because they'll get too much tannin and they'll die. And I just find that to be completely wrong. I'm sorry, and I'd like your thoughts on it.
Oh, my. Well, we've run chickens for decades here, and they go in the woods, and we've certainly never had one die from acorns. I don't know if a chicken can actually eat an acorn. That's a pretty big deal. That sounds like a pretty big swallow to me.
Yeah, I mean, I do know in the Great Depression that some farmers would crack acorns for their chickens because they couldn't afford, you know, enough feed, and they would supplement it with that. And my thing is that animals know better than eat something's going to kill them. Chickens can do some dumb stuff. They really can. But usually they eat things that are going to kill them when it's not like a natural thing. You know, it's like they'll eat a wing nut, or I've seen that, you know. chicken eat a wing nut. That didn't work out real well for the chicken. I've seen some stuff like that. I also was listening to the interview that you gave Jason Akers up in Pennsylvania at the Mother Earth News Fair. And, like, the one thing that really, like, got me, because we talk about sprouting here a lot, but for people, you have been kind of experimenting with sprouting for chickens.
Yeah.
You want to tell folks?
We're experimenting. I'm certainly not an expert yet, but that is on my list of hot things that I want to do a lot more with. The basic idea of sprouting is that it takes a given amount of grain, you know, take a bushel of grain, and it increases its nutrient value depending on who you read after by a factor of anywhere of, you know, two times to seven times. And the problem with sprouting is that there's so much handling. The way it's typically done, there's so much handling involved, you know, to move this now, you know, watery, heavy, perishable material. That, you know, the second thing, of course, is that it's now perishable instead of being relatively stable like dried grains are. So, you know, there are problems with it. But if you can figure out how to do it efficiently and not have to and feed it right out as it's sprouted, then, you know, to be able to take a bushel of barley or a bushel of oats or rye or something and, you know, triple its nutrient value as feed value, you know, that's not something to be taken lightly. That'd be pretty cool.
And you had this idea for this, like, what'd you call it? Like a Ferris wheel.
Yeah, I call it a Ferris wheel sprouter. The idea is that, you know how a Ferris wheel is. Well, this would be something maybe 5 feet in diameter, and you would hang about 8 seats. The seats would be trays, say 18 inches by, you know, 5 feet maybe, and it would hold a, you know, 5-gallon bucket full of soaked grain. And every day you advance this Ferris wheel one step, so that in 8 days, at the eighth day, the tray is back down at the bottom of the Ferris wheel, and it's just high, it's just perfect height off the ground for chickens to reach in there and self-harvest. That way, you just handle them one time from the soak bucket into the tray, and the chickens then, self-feed out. And, of course, to keep the chickens off of the other trays, you'd have to put, you know, the ones before they were ready from jumping up there, you'd have to put some sort of a cloak. So my idea was to put a slatted cloak, you know, just a cloak, a hoop over those trays that the chickens could roost on, so that in the winter when we have the chickens in the greenhouses, the hoop houses, they get warm in the day, but they get cold at night. This way, the chickens would jump up there and roost at night and be a chicken blanket on the sprouts to keep them warm at night, so you could keep sprouting, you know, through the coldest part of winter. Yeah. These are just ideas. This is how I think.
That's awesome.
I have no idea if it'll work or if we'll encounter something that we didn't anticipate, but that's definitely on my, on my to-do list.
Well, cool. Hey, man, I've got some questions coming in on Facebook for you. Maybe I can throw a few of those at you, kind of like a lightning round here towards the end.
Sure.
We'll see how much of a light, because I know there's some deep stuff, too, though. We'll see how we can lightning it, though. But Ben says, other than, quote, voting with your feet, end quote, what are some other steps people can do to fight city ordinances restricting farming?
Well, I'm a big believer in civil disobedience. And I think that it's a lot easier to ask forgiveness than permission. And so I think that if thousands of us just went out and did what we knew was right, we would have a lot more freedom than we would by, you know, trying to toe the line to everybody.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I like, we had the one lady they tried to put in jail. It was in Michigan. And I put it out on my show and just basically said, here's the number to everybody at that city government, call them. And they eventually backed off, and it wasn't just me, it was hundreds of people doing stuff like that with blogs and all. And I don't think that that's gone unnoticed, and I think this, like, Nazi-esque enforcement of this stuff, that cities and towns are going to, the more we fight and the more we do it anyway and the more we are heard, the less likely they are going to be to do that type of thing to us. Next one for you. David Galloway says, in the years since you wrote You Can Farm, do you still think the best way to get started in agriculture is to rent 20 acres and raise broiler hens and eggs?
That's a great question. I haven't seen anything that's as quick a turnaround. I mean, America's eating chicken. It's a very low cost thing. It's an 8-week turnaround time from start to finish. That's as fast as a radish. And you know, it's a cheap way in. Again, you know, it's not a great big piece like beef and stuff. And I still have not seen, in my opinion, a slicker, more efficient way to jump in than with the pastured broiler.
Awesome. So that stood the test of time. You got a real fan there, too, that even knew that was all the way back to one of your first books. Same guy says, do you favor local grasses and weeds to make your salad bar pasture, or do you also mix in non-local varieties?
Essentially, our pastures are all whatever's been growing. We've never planted a seed in 50 years, and we have watched the complexion of the pasture change dramatically in those 50 years. I think generally that nature knows best on this, and whatever's most climatized and is most nativized to your region, I think will gravitate to your situation. And if you think about it, generally whatever's in the side ditches of the road is the most resilient species of forage that is the most prolific with the least amount of input in your area. And so I say stay with what's there and what comes naturally.
Awesome. Lydia says, if you're in an arid situation, what are the best poultry to raise, and any recommendations for good dairy goats?
What I don't know about dairy goats would fill a library, so I'm not even going to touch the dairy goats. I just don't know much about them. I just know you got to have a really good fence to keep them in, and I tend to not raise things that are smarter than I am, so I tend to stay away from dairy goats. Arid situations, poultry in arid situations, I don't know if she's asking well, and she says arid. I don't know if this is arid hot or arid cold, but you know, generally arid hot, you would take your, for example, raising broilers, you would take your time off in the middle of the summer and raise them through the winter. If you're arid cold, you'd take your time off in the winter and raise them through the summer. I don't see that there's a big difference. I will tell you this, that we've had extremely good success in the last 2 years bringing in the French La Belle Rouge broiler, which is a red-colored chicken. It's the French broiler bird, the double-breasted. Grows about 20% slower than the Cornish Cross American broiler. So it doesn't have quite as plump a breast, doesn't grow quite as fast, is not quite as feed efficient. However, it does graze a lot better, and it definitely is hardier. And it has a much more brilliant fat. So we have found a wonderful market acceptance, and that might be something you might look at in a more harsh environment.
Excellent, excellent. Next one, just kind of a comment for you. I think it'll make you chuckle a little bit. Waylon Cook says, Joel Salatin for president. Those bumper stickers are the best.
Well, I can't complain about the job, but I don't think the pay is enough.
All right. Karen Pennington says, what is most important, locally raised foods or organic?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not certified organic. I don't participate in any government programs, and I think that since the government now owns the word organic, there's been a tremendous amount of adulteration in the in the word. All you have to do is check out cornucopia.com. That's a group of attorneys in Wisconsin that it seems like every Monday morning they're having to sue the USDA again to enforce their own organic standards. I guess my position on that is I can't imagine why people think that the government, which has poo-pooed organics from day one, could possibly be a good administrator of the organic, of the word organic. So the beauty of local is that you can actually go check it out, see it, and the beginning of integrity is transparency. You can't have accountability and integrity without transparency. So at the end of the day, the being able to see it and touch it and smell it and participate with it is far more transparent than any kind of label, organic or otherwise.
Yeah, I've actually been working on something. I wasn't even going to bring it up on the air because I want to take your airtime up with it, but I'd like you to know about it now that you mentioned that. I've started putting together a program called AgriTrue, and the tagline means truth in agriculture, and my belief is that if you want honesty about your food, ask the farmer that grew it, and he'll tell you. And he'll tell you whether he's using GMO Tyson garbage or doing beyond organic, and he'll tell you whatever you want to know, and we can take a farmer at his word. And my hope is to set some standards, but mainly so that the buyer can, with one quick swipe of a smartphone, know exactly where their stuff was grown, see pictures of the farm, see the farmer, ask the farmer a question, and we're working on that. We kind of got a big setback. I hired a coder to start building the site, and he kind of just stopped building the site and disappeared. So we got a mess there, but I'd actually like you to know more about that.
Tyson men, right?
Yeah. But that's just my belief, is that if people would get in touch with their producers, and that's a very, very local production, centric thing, because it's ideally made for the small producer, the guy with, 100 acres or less, the guy that is selling from farms and things like that. And I go to the farmers markets, and I see the people that have pictures of their farm, like on a board and all, and I'm like, if we could just harness technology to let people connect that way. And I heard your interview. I don't remember who you gave it to, but you're in your truck driving, and you were talking about going to the local farmer's market. It'd be better if you had one place to pay for everything.
Right.
And I was thinking, man, that kind of lets that whole thing work even on a bigger level, because you could go into like a co-op of all local producers, and they don't have to be there. They can be off running their farm, and you still know who you're buying from. Just by the bin that it's in. So
yeah, the fluidity of preserving integrity in the local food distribution network is huge right now. I mean, everybody's got an idea, and all these ideas, your idea, these are all good. Ultimately, it ultimately you cannot have an honest food system without heavy participation, just like you can't have good politics without a lot of participation. You know, you can't abdicate your civic responsibility and assume that, well, you know, those people, them, they, those over there, somebody is going to vote for the right person. At the end of the day, we get exactly what we deserve, and we get the kind of food we deserve, we get the kind of politics we deserve, we get the kind of policy we deserve. And so ultimately, it's about participatory, you know, participatory involvement in the system, whether it's food, you know, policy or whatever. And so you're right. It's all about participation.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. Here's David asking, ask him what he thinks of paleo nutrition. I know one of his drivers lost 200 pounds after working for him and eating clean food from his farm. I don't know if you know this or not, but you are like a hero in the paleo world. Like, I'm big on paleo nutrition. Rob Wolf was on the show last week. He's featured you on his site a bunch. But because you're showing how to make meat sustainable, you're really a big, you know, you have a huge fan base in that world, because what we're always told is you have to eat soybeans and wheat. That's sustainable. What are your thoughts on paleo nutrition and sustainability of meat in general?
Oh, well, it's a great question. Absolutely. I'm a friend of the paleo, you know, the paleo world. And the basic concept on animals is, and if you get my book, Folks, This Ain't Normal, you'll see this very clearly articulated. The problem with omnivores is that we have put them in a cage, like you said, put them in a cage and given them grain, which is a totally abnormal, unnatural world for omnivores. The foundation of all cultures throughout history has been the herbivore, because the herbivore was the only nutrient-dense product. And when I say herbivore now, that's not just cows. That's buffalo, camels, zebras, yaks, reindeer, you know,
squirrels, rats, guinea pigs.
Sheep, goats, yeah. And the point is that the reason that the herbivore was the foundation of all the societies that actually survived was because that was nutrient density from a perennial that did not require planting or tillage. And in a day before cheap energy and mechanical power and machinery, when tillage was extremely laborious, it was extremely difficult to do. And so the cultures, in fact, you know, I don't know if you've read the Jared Diamond's book, Collapse. But when you read Collapse, one of the most amazing things that he does not address in that, whatever it is, 800-page book, is the dot that he doesn't connect is that all of the cultures that collapsed, all of them, none of them had herbivores. They were non-herbivorous cultures. And so it's important to understand the role of the herbivore, and now for the first time in human civilization, we're able to duplicate the large marauding, stampeding groups of herbivores and predators that were, you know, the way they were done throughout history. We can duplicate that now with very high-tech electric fencing and portable infrastructure. We've never been able to do that before. Now we can do it, so we can tap into this wonderful carbon sequestering, soil building, hydrology stimulating natural system of herbivore, perennial, temporary disturbance, and long-term rest periods between applications. The herbivore is absolutely the key to ecological enhancement and nutrient density.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm not going to try to even add anything to that. That's just great. Real quick one here. Do you have any suggestion for a better tonic for the health of his chickens' respiratory system other than cider vinegar and garlic that he gives them once a month in their water?
Well, the only thing I would add about health for chickens is there's a wonderful, you know, organic premix made by Fertrel. And whenever anybody asks about, you know, poultry trouble, my first question is, are you using Fertrel premixes, which is a Bainbridge, Pennsylvania company, OMRI certified, and as if certification means anything. Anyway, it's primarily seaweed, food grade soft rock phosphates, and vitamins and minerals, and it goes in at 60 pounds per ton. And to me, that's my first line of defense on just, you know, vigorous poultry, other than just good, you know, good sanitation practices.
Awesome. One more for you, and it's an easy one. Is he still raising his turkeys with his grapes, or has he created a new process?
Raising turkeys with, what was the word?
Grapes.
Grape?
Yeah. Did you raise turkeys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great question. Yes, in fact, we do. And, I mean, we raise turkeys other places as well, not just the vineyard, but absolutely under the vineyard. I will tell you one fascinating thing that we just started 2 years ago was under the grapes and under the orchard trees, we have a mulch of wood chips, and of course the turkeys and chickens, when they come through there, they'll you know, scratch that out and make a mess. And we have it confined with an 8x8 box, like 4 feet by 4 feet of box with the chips in there. And so 2 years ago, one of our interns came back to be a horticulturalist here, and he inoculated those chip beds with Winecat Stropharium, mushroom spawn, and these mycelium spread down through those wood chips and glue them all together with those white fussy strands of mycelium, so the poultry can't scratch the mulch covers out from under the orchard trees and the vineyard, and it makes a much easier way to keep them. And you know, during the 2 months of bloom every year, you've got these wonderful big, you know, six inch diameter $10 Winecat Stropharium mushrooms to sell or to eat. So it's another win-win situation.
Very awesome. And just another example of how things get integrated together. Well, we've kind of wrapped things up, Joel. I want to make sure people know how they can find more about you, get your books and all. Your website is polyfacefarms.com. I'll have a link to that in today's show notes. I'm going to read off the books I have listed for you here. You tell me if I missed any. Pastured Poultry Profits, Salad Bar Beef, You Can Farm, Family Friendly Farming, Holy Cows, and Hog Heaven. Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal, and that one I think people really need to read. The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer, and folks, This Ain't Normal. I've got those all listed in the show notes for people so they can find them real easy. Did I miss any?
No, you didn't miss a one. You got every single one of them. There's 8 of them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, folks, I mean, Joel's done a lot of great work, and one way you can really support a person and let them know that their work is valuable is to step up and, you know, do business with them. And you may not be able to drive down the road and pick up a couple chickens from Joel, but you could pick up his books. Do you have one, like, if people, like, just were going to, like, just say that this is the first time they heard of you and they wanted to get one book of yours to get to know you and what you're all about, would there be one you'd say is the best first book for someone to buy?
Sure. This Ain't Normal would be the one that I would recommend. That's the latest one, and it's the most a big picture, cultural picture stuff with a lot of little, personal how-to stuff that even, you know, non-landed folks, even urban folks can enjoy.
Well, great, man. Hey, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking time to be on my show with me today. The show is listened to by about 25,000 people. And we're here at the end of the show, and I want to make sure that anything you want to tell those folks, I give you the opportunity to do so. So if you have any final thoughts, please take all the time you need and just say whatever you'd like to say.
Well, I'll just share this because it's just been one of those little, you know, epiphany pieces of advice that has served me so well. And that is, you know, we've all grown up with this mental picture of grandma standing over us saying, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. You know, we've heard that so many, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And I got news for you, grandma was wrong. The truth is that if it's worth doing poorly first. Nobody does it right the first time. And so what happens is that we have this image, you know, of if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And what it does is it stigmatizes us from innovating in our own lives. And we're scared to death of, you know, what if the cake fails? What if the canner blows up? What if bugs attack the beans? you know, what if the chicken gets sick? I mean, we've got all these, you know, oh, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right, you know. And we're scared to death to attempt new things because we've got this, you know, this thing about having to do it right the first time. And so my encouragement is, anything that's worth doing is worth doing poorly first. Nobody does it right the first time. We don't write well the first time. We don't ride a bicycle well the first time. We don't walk well the first time. You know, we don't even poop well the first time. We got to learn how to do that. And so just, you know, just run out there and be innovative, do something, you know, move out of your comfort zone. And do it poorly first and enjoy doing it poorly, because it's in doing it poorly that you eventually do become skillful enough to do it right.
Man, that's great advice. And I think you could take that, not just farming and not just homesteading, but that's the same advice I used to give my sales teams back when I had, you know, they called a regular day job. So that's just awesome. Also, folks, I want to let you guys know, again, polyfacefarms.com, Joel's website, will be linked from today's show notes. And if you want to meet Joel and me, you can meet both of us. We will both be speakers in Nashville, New Hampshire, February 23rd through 26, 2012, at the Free State Projects Liberty Forum. So, Joel, I'm looking forward to shaking your hand and meeting you in person.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting you, too. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to so many wonderful people.
All right, folks. And with that, today this has been Jack Spirico along with Joel Salatin, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
There's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, and we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.